Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Friday, May 1st, 2020, which means that the cruelest month is finally over, and let it have been the cruelest month. A month in which almost 60,000 Americans, or about 60,000 Americans, died from COVID-19. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine. With me, as always, senior editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Associate editor Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And senior writer Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
Once again, we're in a weird situation in which the news, if you want to take it as such, on the, you know, on the worst hotspot in America, which is New York City, where I'm talking to you from, is guardedly better. It keeps getting better, though, you know, saying that 205 people died yesterday from COVID doesn't sound great, and it isn't great, but it's better than 700, you know, which was the case a week ago. Hospitalizations are down, intubations are down, all of that stuff is down. And so that does mean that we did apparently hit the peak and are now, heading down. And now, interestingly enough, apparently the per capita death rate in New Jersey is now exceeded the per capita death rate in New York State. So that suggests that the measures that have been taken have been successful, and people should be, you know, I mean, it's better to have gone through this with some reason to think that the difficulties that we have all been enduring have been for good reason. Noah, there was an interesting, your governor, Governor Murphy of New Jersey, announced that he was reopening parks and what else? Parks and a couple of other
golf
things.
Courses.
Golf courses, right. And that, but he then said, sounding like a parent of unruly kids in the back seat, if you misbehave, don't think I won't close them back up again.
Yeah, and so
I'm going to turn this car around, mister.
Precisely. And that's, I mean, there's a weird thing that's occurring with me where I'm increasingly more tolerant of the radicals on either side of this thing than people who speak to me in such a paternalistic fashion and are otherwise behaving rationally. So if you're on the side of this that says, you know, we need lockdowns in perpetuity until there's some sort of scientific miracle, if it takes 3 years, it takes 3 years. What are you, some kind of a sociopath? You want people to die? Great. Good for you. See you never. If you're on the other side of that thing and you're saying we need to open up everything, I don't care who dies, this is an economic catastrophe and we're in the middle of it and this is unsustainable, I say, you know what? I feel your pain. I get you. If you're like Governor Murphy, however, who has always behaved as though he was presiding over a social experiment and not a state, and you do this kind of semi-rational thing where you acknowledge the reality on the ground, which is the enforcement of the lockdown of parks. Maybe it works in Hoboken. I haven't been there in quite some time. But it doesn't work here, where you're talking about policing vast pastoral settings where people are just simply not policed out of them. Just acknowledging the fact on the ground and taking credit for it and then saying, but don't you abuse this privilege or I will take it back away from you, makes me want to, you know, grab a pitchfork and head right to the town square.
Right. You know, another interesting thing happened in New York City that bodes for a fascinating transformation. This is just a small thing. It's a small but very big thing if you live here. Governor Cuomo announced that the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, which runs the subways, was going to shut the New York City subways down from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. to disinfect the cars every night, so that for dealing with COVID stuff. The interesting question, New York City has a 24-hour subway system. I believe it may be the only 24-hour, 365, never-stopping mass transit system in the world. I could be wrong, but certainly London, Paris, Moscow, the major systems in the world mostly shut down for 4 to 6 hours every night. The question is, will New York ever reopen its 24 hours, 7 day a week, 365 day a year schedule? Because it probably shouldn't. One of the reasons that the subway system has is dirty and degraded is that there is no time to clean the stations, as there is in London. And the stations, if you've been there, are pristine at all times. A lot of track work can be done, a lot of signal fixing and stuff like that, if there is a period of time during the day when the system isn't running. But this would represent a gigantic spiritual change in New York City, you know, which is the city that never sleeps, according to the song, because, of, among other things, there is a subway running through it at all times. And that's where you could see how this event might have long-lasting definitional ramifications for a place like New York that we're already beginning to start thinking about seriously. Like, what is a New York where people don't feel comfortable going to the theater or going to crowded small restaurants or something like that for how long? Will we simply snap back and live the way we did before, or will there be enough people, 10, 15, 20%, who are no longer comfortable in settings like that, that they cannot be run on a profitable basis? And so much of what we take to be the reasons that people live in the city, as Abe has been saying, vanish. You know, we live in small, living on top of each other in small spaces, relatively small spaces. And if you're doing so voluntarily, not just because this is where you're from or this is where your family is or whatever, but and where your job is, but because you've chosen to live here, there's not going to be that much reason to continue living here.
Yeah, I mean, I think the subway change, as you mentioned, John, is a good one, right? I mean, if that happens, then we'll at least have relatively clean trains, you know, or at least for a 24-hour cycle. But as for the other stuff, I think part of the problem is that we have people saying all day, every day, on every screen, we're not going to go back to where we were. There'll be a normal, but it'll be a different normal. We'll be smarter. We'll do this. We'll do that. And all these ideas about smarter and even improved, as Cuomo likes to say, all actually sound like a nightmare to me. I mean, I think the goal really should be to go back to exactly where we were. Now, that doesn't mean it happens instantly, but if we cannot, again, there is no such thing as a New York without, there's no such thing as a New York with social distancing, actually. I mean, we are a crowd-centric city, and you can delay that, but you can't say we're going to alter that, because it just won't be the same, and it'll die financially.
I thought Michael Brendan Doherty over at National Review had an interesting piece along these lines. Everybody's sort of contemplating what the new normal will look like, because we'll never go back to the way things were before. And, you know, just on a really philosophical level, he surveyed the environment and said, I haven't really encountered anybody whose aspirations have changed as a result of this. You know, who's got a more truncated idea of what life should look like for them, their objectives, their what they want for themselves and their families and their futures? You know, what is the environment that they want to see changed? And I always thought that was a very interesting question, because, you know, there's a lot of people who talk about this in very academic terms and in terms of, you know, personal safety. But in the long term, what are they willing to sacrifice? What have they decided that they can give up?
I have an answer for that. And Christine, maybe you can reflect on this a little bit. So 15 years ago, maybe 10, 12 years ago, there was a bedbug panic in New York City. And there's some reason to think that this panic was created in part by the bedbug suppression business. You know, one of those things where suddenly stories are appearing about bedbugs everywhere, and people start panicking about bedbugs. And I knew several people who stopped going to movie theaters permanently because there were stories that there had been bedbugs in the AMC Lincoln Square or something like that. And I'm talking about perfectly rational people, but germaphobes, people who find the thought of bedbugs, which are, of course, horrible. I mean, they're annoying and they bite you and all this, but, you know, they're not lice, and they don't carry disease. They're just an incredibly unpleasant thing, or can be. So I've seen in my lifetime the way in which a certain type of germophobia can interfere with people's lives. Certainly in going back another 20 years, there were these, chemical sensitivity panic, where people were saying it was giving them Epstein-Barr. They were getting sick from scents in products and stuff like that. And I mean, it's a negligible number if you take it as part of the entire population. But if, you know, a million people out of 330 million people do it, it's 1/330. But, you know, if 5% of people do it in businesses and friends, that is the profit margin. If you lose 5% of your customer base in a business that has a 3% profit margin, you're in deep trouble. So this psychology, this is the question. It's like, better, you know what, I'm not going to go to restaurants anymore. I mean, I could get sick. Maybe I won't get coronavirus, but, you know, I could get the flu. I could get this. I could get that. You sort of look at people as though they are invisibly radiating disease, and they're near you and they're invisibly radiating disease and or shedding virus or whatever you want to call it. And I don't know how you get over that psychologically if you're a person inclined to that kind of feeling.
Well, I think that's it's a good point. But perhaps counterexample would be to look at the security theater post 9/11 that we all endured, and that was noticeably disruptive to our routines, especially if you were someone who traveled a lot. You had to start taking your belt off, and then you had to take your shoes off, then you had to take your computer bag out, and then you had to put everything in a little Ziploc that was the right size and no liquids. And each level of additional security was a temporary but noticeable disruption of a once more seamless experience. But it is one that I think we can all agree we've adjusted to, right? And then, as you see, as more time goes on, there's been, as there is in everything in America, a way to buy your way around some of the inconvenience. You can get the clear that, you know, if you're not, in fact, a terrorist in training, it's pretty easy to buy a way around those lines and whatnot. So I do feel like there will definitely be a period of, particularly if you're a business owner and in the restaurant business, especially, a period of great pain and adjustment here that will affect people in the same way that I knew some frequent travelers who did cut back on their travel post 9/11, not out of fear necessarily of dying in a terrorist attack, but just out of the huge headache and inconvenience of dealing with those disruptions. So I think that we'll see that as well here. But I do feel like there's always a very small percentage of people who are just kind of hardwired to react permanently in the way that you described your friends who were concerned about bed bugs. We're going to see that here too. That's absolutely going to be a problem. I will note that one of my kids is a real sci-fi fanatic, and we started watching this new Amazon series last night called Upload, which is about kind of set in a slightly futuristic time, including in a slightly futuristic New York City. And the first thing my kids noticed about one of the episodes is that they show a really packed bus in New York, and half of the people are wearing masks and the other half are not. And they instantly noticed this, because obviously we all have to put masks on when we go to the grocery store and stuff. So it was, to me, it struck me as, so this is supposed to be 10, 20 years in the future. You will probably see that kind of adjustment. I mean, we will have a permanent change to our daily practical behaviors if we live in cities, and that's not necessarily bad.
I think cities are going to be younger, and by that I mean the people going out and doing things and participating in groups are going to be represented significantly by the younger people in the city. They've already got the message. Perhaps too clearly that they are the least at risk. You know, I think they're ready to go out now.
Okay, so why don't we turn from these unanswerable, depressing questions to the delicious hypocrisy of the last 24 to 48 hours. Joe Biden went on Morning Joe this morning to dispute the contention of his almost three decade ago staffer, Tara Reid, that basically that he raped her. I mean, it's basically what the accusation is, that he pushed her up against a wall and violated her. And he says it didn't happen, and he is now directing the National Archives. I can't quite figure out. There's some place he says if she had reported this to any authority in the Senate, that there would be a record of it there, and if it's not there, then that proves that it didn't happen. She apparently has already responded that she told somebody, but she doesn't remember who, that he made her feel uncomfortable, but she doesn't remember when. And so there are two aspects of this, one of which is that Biden is dealing with an accusation of a sort that he was perfectly willing to accept the truth of such accusations, say, on college campuses against any, you know, 19-year-old boy. We're supposed to believe any accusation hurled and give the preponderance of doubt, or, you know, preponderance of evidence should go to the 51%. If there's 51% credibility to a charge, the charge should be believed, but not for himself. So there's that, and then there is also the media starting to twist itself into knots, trying to figure out how to handle this. Christine?
So the one important note of context here, the reason this Morning Joe interview was remarkable is that so March 25th was when Ms. Reid made her initial allegation, you know, in the media. Biden did 25 interviews since then and was never once asked about Tara Reid. That is the part that for a lot of us who follow the Kavanaugh hearings closely, the Kavanaugh accusations closely, are sort of astonished by. So that is the reason this particular Morning Joe incident this morning is so unusual, because it's the first time he was asked about it. I mean, we've talked about this before. I don't find her allegations particularly compelling, but Joe Biden is in a whole lot of trouble, and it's going to continue. I mean, you know, one of the people who came to his defense yesterday, the president, he said, oh, I don't know anything about it, but boy, do I know about false accusations. I've experienced it. Poor Brett Kavanaugh experienced it. I mean, if the person rushing to your defense is the president of the United States, who's been, you know, pretty credibly accused by a lot of women of assault and inappropriate behavior, then you've got to really be worried. And we also know that behind the scenes, his campaign has been scrambling to try to get a unified message out and to get surrogates to say the same thing. And each time they come out and say those things, there's a fair amount of pushback. Look, Kirsten Gillibrand, another pretty major hypocrite here when it comes to the Me Too moment. And we talked about Stacey Abrams. So I think this is just the beginning for Joe Biden and this problem.
Noah.
Yeah, I mean, well, I wrote about this for the website. The media's role here is not responsible per se, but it's more responsible than what we've seen during the Kavanaugh affair. And these are almost the reason why this comes up so often is because the parallels are hard to ignore. The press has responded to these accusations, as you should respond to accusations with criminal weight, the gravity of which is so great that the evidentiary burden should be sufficiently high. And so perhaps the month and a half that elapsed was unjustifiable. But nevertheless, investigating these allegations dispassionately and allowing for the investigation to come forward and not taking the weight of the accusation alone as evidence of guilt is what the press is supposed to do. And they did that to an extent in this case. What they have not done is hold themselves to the standard that they established during the Kavanaugh affair. And when you say the media, you know, your blanket indicting a whole broad swath of opinion and reportorial institutions, and that's not entirely fair. But in the Kavanaugh case, it really is, because it was almost entirely universal. The extent to which Joe Biden, or rather Brett Kavanaugh's own defense of himself, was evidence of his guilt, and not just his guilt, but the avatar that he represented. He was a stand-in for white heterosexual men of a particular socioeconomic background. And those individuals were suspect. They deserved to a comeuppance, a cosmic comeuppance. And the extent to which he defended himself with some passion against these charges was more evidence, not just of his own guilt in the minds of whole broad swaths of big players in press and in politics, but in the press in particular. So, you know, if that's the standard, then Joe Biden should have approached this, you know, the prospect of his own guilt with some dispassion, you know, be a little open-minded about the prospect that you might have raped this person. At least that's the standard that should have been applied here.
Don't get angry. Don't get angry.
Yeah, certainly. Or if you don't defend yourself with some passion, then, you know, that's a little suspect too. There was a variety of behaviors that media engaged in order to contort itself into knots, in order to upend and thwart the Supreme Court nomination. It was a political objective. Everybody on our side of the aisle said as much at the time, and it's pretty plain that that's the case now. And you had Mika Brzezinski come out after this interview and say, you know, this is a pretty tough one for me. I like Joe Biden. I still like Joe Biden. I respect Joe Biden. But, you know, the believe all women standard is not being applied here. So were Democrats wrong then, or are they wrong now? She's foreclosed upon the option that they were not wrong, which is right and good.
So, Abe, let me ask you this. In 2013, when Reid blew up the filibuster for lower level judicial nominations, right? And announced that they were going to just take a up and down majority minority vote in the Senate to confirm judges. Mitch McConnell spoke the truth. He said, "You will regret this, because one day this standard, you will not be in power, and this standard will be in the hands of people you don't like, and then you will reap the whirlwind." And what has happened over the last 3 years? What has happened over the last 3 years is that the McConnell and Trump administration have used Harry Reid's relaxation of these rules to confirm hundreds and hundreds of judges who might have been filibustered under a previous system. And this is how politics actually works. When Democrats were loosing, the jackals on Brett Kavanaugh, just as they loosed the jackals on Clarence Thomas and all of that, this idea is, you really think that you can successfully isolate this to the people that you don't like? Because you can't. That's not the way these things work. And if you inflate a problematic accusation to the level of the most important news story in the world because you are worried about a permanent lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court, and believe, which is, I believe, is the case, believe that under those conditions, all bets are off, and that you have to do whatever you can do to stop somebody from getting on the court, that the same thing's going to happen to you when it's your presidential nominee. And for whatever reason, I don't think Tara Reid is clearly not a, you know, Trump plant, I don't think. But she has other reasons for doing this. And had you held to a standard of evidentiary simple, there, the fact that her mother said something on Larry King is not evidence that it happened. It could be evidence that she, you know, dreamed up a fantasy about something that happened between her and Joe Biden and talked about it at the time. And this is now hardened into a deep, you know, permanent recollection that is not real, which is something we learned about the, you know, people's buried memories or stuff like that 25 years ago. That's, I think, why we're enjoying this, right? In some funny way. It's like, okay, you, you really thought that you could do X and there would not be Y consequence? Welcome to the consequence.
The danger here is that principle gets sort of pushed aside in favor of strategy or political tactics, right? So even if you had strongly believed or even still believe in so that someone is innocent until proven guilty, and that an accusation does not mean is not evidence of guilt, that is one thing. But it is at the same time, it is very delicious to have your political opponent flailing and struggling or just being in the spotlight for something that he may or may not have done. So, yeah, but I don't think, but we haven't seen Republicans yet pile on in the way that Democrats did, say, in the case of Kavanaugh. The Republican and the conservative take on this has continued to be pointing out media hypocrisy primarily, right?
Right.
It hasn't been, my God, Joe Biden is a monster rapist.
No, and they're in the position of being consistent, which is, you know, easier than what you've seen the most committed liberal analysts do in this moment, who are, you know, groping in the dark for some sort of a logical explanation that suffices for "I just really hate Republicans." They're, you know, the Kavanaugh was a less credible defender. You know, his particular background had been X, Y, and Z. You know, there are a host of justifications, self-justifications that are really flimsy, but are designed only to, you know, make them feel better about what is essentially this glaring double standard that's been really exposed here. And the people who are a little bit more honest brokers on the left are confronting the contradictions that they've been courting for the last 2 years. And that's probably a good thing. But yeah, Republicans put themselves in actually a pretty advantageous position by being consistent here, that they've said, you know, that the weight of the evidence should be weighed as evidence, and the accusation alone does not suffice for evidence. And that's the position they applied to Kavanaugh. That's the position they're applying to Joe Biden. And they've been vindicated by their critics, by people like Ruth Marcus at The Washington Post, who said, "Believe all women is a terrible standard. It's just an unjust standard." Right. Exactly right. So it's, you know, probably just a matter of time before Republicans are all, you know, feted for their prudence and forbearance, and you know, we can just sit back and wait for all the accolades.
I'm wondering if in terms of the way the vigorousness with which we've seen in the last few days people like Nancy Pelosi and others come out and defend Joe, the defense of Joe's dad once lost his job, so we should believe that he did not attack a woman, is a very strange leap that she made, but there you go. But I, you know, the other thing that made news briefly with Biden was that he has started talking to himself as a transition candidate, right? Not transition in the sort of, there is no gender. Right? Now that would be
interesting. Not a gender issue, yeah.
This is about how he sees himself as the sort of a transition to a younger, you know, he mentioned Mayor Pete. He's like, "Oh, I'm going to bring the Mayor Pete's of the world into my administration." So the idea that he's almost setting himself up as a one-term president, running as a kind of one-term president, is interesting to me because it suggests that this is new, right? He wasn't talking this way in, you know, 3 months ago. So I don't know if that comes into play in terms of how vigorously it's basically just, let's get Trump out of here. Let's put someone, anyone in there, you know, any functioning adult 2020. As you've
I mean, it is interesting that I think the we know very little about how the Biden campaign is functioning or who he listens to, or it's kind of remarkable actually how opaque some of this stuff is and what was throughout 2019. That they decided to take a slow and steady, long-term plotting strategy. And despite all of this complaining about how he wasn't doing it right, and obviously he was doing it exactly and entirely right, actually including, you know, you may even look at this in the long term and say that what he needed to really win this thing decisively as quickly as he did was for Bernie to win a couple of things and scare the bejesus out of, you know, out of the Democratic Party at the possibility that Bernie was going to be the nominee. You could almost say that, you know, if Biden had planned that, it wouldn't be any better. But we don't really know how he is functioning. So the question is, was he musing yesterday when he said, "I'm a transitional candidate"? Or is this a strategy? Like, do they think that what they have, and they've done polling and they've done this and they've done that, and what they have is, I am the person to get us out of this, whatever it is, Trump's presidency and the virus, Trump's whatever, and that's what I am here for. Onto me whatever you like, say whatever you like. I'm not going to change the, you know, course of American history. I'm 78 years old. I'm not going to do that. So I'm here to be the person who can lead us into the next phase.
This wasn't, you know, there was a float a couple of months back. And I don't know whether it came from the Biden campaign or not, but it didn't seem like it came from his adversaries that Joe Biden might flirt with just being a one-term president. Now, there's a reason why you don't take a one-term pledge. It is politically maladroit, to say nothing of the fact that it's usually unfulfillable. People like to have their legacies restored by the verdict of the public after 4 years, or affirmed at least, rather. At the risk of treading through a minefield here, I don't think that the Biden campaign believes that Joe Biden can serve for two consecutive terms. I don't think he is physically capable of doing so. But they are at extreme risk by introducing that into the public dialogue.
Totally. Yeah, that's my impression too. He's sort of taking away his own vote of confidence in himself in a way. You know,
I don't know. See, I don't know, because again, like I mean, I think it's easy to look at it that way. And then there's also what the realities are of being the oldest person. Remember, Ronald Reagan was younger than Joe Biden is now when he completed his second term.
Yeah.
So I mean, Biden.
Age. It's mental faculties. Well, no one has as much consideration over Donald Trump, who's of a comparable age, or Bernie Sanders,
he's not of a
who's
comparable
ancient.
Age. Trump is 4 years younger than Biden.
Yeah, four is comparable.
No, it's not.
Debatable.
Okay,
I'm not conceding the point. It's debatable. Nevertheless, Joe Biden is evincing is a lack of mental acuity.
All I'm trying to say is that you run with the hand you have, right? Not the hand you want to have. And you have to play the hand that you can play. And if they have looked at these things, again, I don't know that this is true, because it could just be him going off on his own and not reflecting a theory of the campaign. And therefore, you know, doesn't mean anything anyway, because he can change his tune and not say it again. But if what they are looking at is, I am the Rorschach, to just, you know, vote for me if you don't want to vote for Trump. And both, you know, Trump has an approval rating over disapproval rating over 50%, number one. And number two, there's this terrible economic crisis and virus and all of that. And so you just want him out of there.
I may be misremembering this, but didn't the issue of a second term, of a potential second term, come up when John McCain last ran for the presidency? And didn't he also perhaps indicate that he would only be one term, or am I wrong about that?
It came up, but people were afraid to talk about it. And number two, it was implicit in the, well, we have to trash Sarah Palin within an inch of her life, because she's, you know, she will be the vice president of the oldest man ever to be sworn in as president. And so you gotta take that seriously.
And nobody was genuinely concerned about John McCain's age. I'm sorry. It was not a genuine concern. It was an attempt to strike an implicit contrast with one of the youngest people to run for president on the Democratic side in the generation.
Right. But so I don't really think, I just think this is a, there are complications to be having very old men run for president. One of them is that, you know, an 82-year-old man is not going to run for re-election. I don't care who the 82-year-old man is. He's not going to run for re-election. He's not one of 100 senators. He's the president of the United States. He will be too old. An 82-year-old man is too old. Do people remember, I mean, you know, when Churchill came back into power in the mid-50s in England, he was falling asleep at the, you know, presiding over tables and having heart attacks and stuff like that. Like, it didn't work. There is a point at which people can be extraordinary and remarkable for their age. But, you know, there's a reason that Clint Eastwood is the only director in the history to make practically to make movies into his late 80s. Like, these are hard jobs. And so, yeah, I mean, if they're raising questions about mental acuity, that's one thing. But again, as with Tara Reid, I'm sorry, but that's not a good hand for Trump to play. And just as Trump has already signaled that this is, Tara Reid is not his issue, right? He said yesterday that, you know, he knows a lot about false accusations of sexual harassment, right? Sort of defending Biden. You know, he's the guy who's staying up until 2 a.m, you know, tweeting, you know, rage tweeting.
Like, yeah, no, Donald, I would not put Donald Trump's, the capacity of Donald Trump for hypocrisy and shamelessness to not overcome the natural impulse among the people around him to avoid, you know, trotting through this minefield.
I don't doubt
that he'll make hay of it.
I do, because it's not that he won't want to, or he'll say, obviously he'll say anything and do anything if it's to his advantage. When he talks about it, he reminds people of himself. That's the problem. It's not that he can't talk about anything that he wants to, but he does not actually need suburban women to be reminded every day of his own sexual peccadilloes. Like, he needs them to, yeah.
But you're assuming he thinks in that rational, politically strategic way. I think I'm with Noah. I think as long as we're talking about him and he's in his mind a persecuted victim of these accusers, not a, you know, poor spokesperson for, you know, good behavior around the opposite sex. I think as long as we're talking about Trump, Trump feels it's a win for him. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I don't think
Noah. But Noah pointed out yesterday that Trump went silent once the reopening of the Comey investigation commenced on October 28th, 2016, and allowed that story to percolate on its own without him, and it helped him get elected, right? So there is some evidence that he has a prudent, he can act prudently if he needs to. And I don't think
unfortunately, the last data point that we have is 4 years old.
Right.
And
we have the data point from yesterday. We have him defending Biden yesterday.
But that's because he feels that there's a weird kinship he feels with Biden, because he thinks, you know, I don't think he thinks he ever did anything wrong with women, Trump. I really don't. I mean, if you listen to how he talks about those interactions and you listen to how he talks about being falsely accused, he is the ultimate victim in his own mind of unfair attacks, politically motivated, whatever, you know. So I think actually his camaraderie with Biden on this score is still a reflection on himself, in the same way that bringing up Kavanaugh for him was, in his judgment, another positive. It shows him as having chosen this really excellent person who was unfairly attacked. I feel like his persecution complex is what drove that, not his political strategy, if that makes sense.
By the way, his claiming public, you know, kinship with Biden on this point doesn't necessarily help Biden either.
No, I think
I mean, it's sort of coming to his defense, but in a way, it's really not, because it's linking the two of them on that score.
I guess I just think, again, that the question becomes, is the election a referendum on Trump or is the election a referendum on Biden? And of course, in 2012, Obama successfully managed the feat of legerdemain of making a re-election effort a referendum on his opponent and not on his presidency, which was the key to his victory in 2012. And Trump may try that. I don't know how on earth that can be the case. Unless, you know, I mean, because he was running against Hillary. They were both not president, right? That was an open seat. He has to account for himself for the last 3.5 years, and maybe the accounting will be, no, we can't really blame him for the virus, or, you know, what's happened to the economic downturn, and things were pretty good before that happened, and so, you know, yeah, I don't like the tweeting, but, you know, better that than, you know, trying something untested. Or it can be the, you know, one way or another, this election is about him. And that's all I'm saying, that Biden, if this was a strategy and not just him ruminating or, you know, glad handing Mayor Pete by saying that he was a transitional candidate, Biden saying, I am just not Trump. I'm not going to even say what I am. I don't even know what I am.
That's exactly
I'll
right.
I'll be whatever you want me to be. I'll be, if you want me to be intersectional, I'm intersectional. If you want me to say the embassy is going to stay in Jerusalem, the embassy is going to stay in Jerusalem. Whatever you want, don't worry about it. I'm going to take the presidency. I'm going to sort of like try to manage things as competently as possible. And then in 2024, you know, pick a commie, pick a neocon. What do I know? You know, I'll be, you know, moving to Florida.
I mean, it's been pretty, it's a pretty clever strategy on his part too. It's not as though Joe Biden has not courted his left flank. He's got a pretty aggressive progressive agenda. Rhetorically, he's been more deferential, and that's why he gets labeled moderate. But he's sort of everything to everyone, and exists therefore as sort of a hypothetical. There's not a whole lot you can pin him down on. And as a hypothetical alternative, you get to avoid the change election narrative, as opposed to the referendum election narrative, which would advance Joe Biden's political prospects pretty significantly, I think. So, you know, if Joe Biden says, you know, I exist as sort of this alternative to Donald Trump, and you can project onto me whatever you want, and you know, all the good stuff and none of the bad stuff. I mean, that was the campaign he was running before. Now, in these conditions, which are so unsatisfactory and so intolerable, I think, across the board, that even becomes more attractive.
Well, look, I mean, you know, we're now at 30 million people have filed for unemployment insurance in the United States. I mean, you know, we have an economy. We're going to see a number. We're going to see a GDP drop number when the second quarter number is issued that no one has ever seen before in the history of the world. If Trump can survive it, it will be a miracle. Now, that the virus is a negative miracle, right? So this is an age of miracles, and so to presume that he can't would be a mistake. You know, the Democrats already dodged. Look, would things be better if you had Bernie Sanders as the spokesman for the party right now, saying that what we need is, you know, healthcare for all? That would be his response to the virus. No, that would be vastly worse, because then you would be handing Trump a, you know, a gigantic fat. It's like, oh, really? You want to go with a $50 trillion buy-in on a new program when we're going to probably have to end up spending like $10 trillion to get us out of this thing? There's not going to be any money in the federal government forever from now on. So, you know, good luck to you. So Biden dodged that bullet. The Democrats dodged that bullet. He has a progressive agenda that doesn't have a price tag and that is notional rather than programmatic. And he wouldn't be able to get it through anyway, right? So, and effectively, he'll end up saying some version of that, which is that, you know, we know what our values are. We're going to reflect and speak for our values of egalitarianism and this, and rights for everybody, and whatever, and, you know, for open borders and everything, however you want to slice it. But
well,
those are our values. That is our notion. That's who we could be. That's who we shall be. That's who we can be when all comes back to normal.
We'll see about what he can and cannot get past. The landscape for Republicans when it comes to the Senate is looking increasingly bleak. Arizona's on the tipping point. And he had a couple of polls out recently from Georgia and North Carolina that look pretty bad for the open seat in Georgia and for Tom Tillis in North Carolina. And you know, Republicans are going to pick up one in Alabama, but they could end up losing three. And
they're going to lose. 50. And apparently, they're going to lose Colorado.
I forgot about Colorado.
Colorado's probably gone. And then there's, of course, Susan Collins in Maine. So Democrats need four to take control of the Senate. But and then the poll, yeah. So that polling is terrible. Yet there is a Gallup poll, which does seem to be an outlier.
Split. Wait a minute. A 50-50 split in the Senate. whoever the vice president is under Joe Biden, the most powerful vice president on the planet in the history of the Republic, is going to be, you know, the chief tie-breaking vote there. That's the president will be de facto a shared office under Joe Biden.
Can we
discuss? And the focus will be on the vice president if there's a 50-50 split.
Yeah. By the way, here's another version of don't start suggesting things that are going to be used against you later. Because, of course, who is more likely to have the 25th Amendment invoked against him? Donald Trump, who, you know, there's been discussion of invoking the 25th Amendment against Trump since, you know, the minute he entered office, or Joe Biden, who, you know, looked to me like he fell asleep during Hillary Clinton's endorsement of him.
All right. Well, we're going to get really nuanced cable news debates about the distinction between crazy and mad.
The distinction between crazy and mad. Yes, that is a good one. All right, so we will bring this week to a close, and as I say, hopefully the month of May will be vastly better than the month of April, if you even think of things in terms of weekends, I hope you all have a very nice weekend.
What is a weekend?
That's what I'm saying. But also, there's a lot of new stuff on streaming, like this show Upload that Christine talked about, right? Debuted last night. Yes. So, also, by the way, let me just mention before we go that I don't know if people listening to me right now were fans of or watched or... you know, have watched since its cancellation, the show Parks and Recreation, the sitcom about a small town in Ohio and its public officials. Last night, Parks and Rec did a reunion special, a half hour show about all its characters in, you know, sort of living through the lockdown and the quarantine on a phone tree where they all, it turns out, are calling each other every night just to check in to see how everybody is doing. It was one of the best half hours of television I've ever seen. So if you did watch Parks and Rec, find it today on demand. If you didn't, I don't even know whether you would be able to make that much sense of it. If you hadn't, but it was still, I thought, deeply moving and very funny and pitch perfect.
Yes, I agree. It was wonderful. And it was also a fun, it also was done as a fundraiser for some really good nonprofits who are helping raise money to feed Americans who are having trouble getting groceries every week since they lost their jobs. So yeah, it was well done. Feeding America, I think, is the group that it was.
Right. Right. So if you watch it, there's a barcode on the screen and there's a phone number and all of that. Anyway, so that's my recommendation for the weekend. So for Abe, Christine, and Noah, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.